Killers always have a story. Linked to their crime might be tales of anger or greed, of betrayal or woe. There might be justification or remorse or pride. Sometimes they will be told eagerly, but sometimes they will be held as unuttered secrets. But they always have a story. The stories I deal with are the special ones, the ones which must be heard and studied and feared. Like the prophecies of the mythological Cassandra, these stories are in fact warnings, and we ignore them at our peril. I am the keeper of the Cassandra files. Episode 4. Who Owns a Nightmare? The Case File of Bobby Marchant. It is said that there is nowhere more frightening than a child's bedroom after the lights go out. The shapes of familiar items, twisted and distorted by shadow and imagination, become the subjects of breathless fear. Or because the darkness becomes the herald of imminent sleep, and with it nightmares which leave you sweating and trembling at a time when you are most alone and vulnerable. It is in this way that Bobby Marchant was perhaps a typical 8-year-old. Every night his parents would bid him good night, turn out his bedroom light, and walk downstairs to continue their evening. The moment Bobby heard the sound of the living room door close, he would bury himself deep in his covers and pray for sleep. When sleep didn't come, he would spend what seemed like hours lying in the silence of his bedroom, hoping that either his mother or father would come upstairs to use the bathroom, or on some other such errand. It would mean that for a few moments he could come out from under the covers which protected him from the unseen horrors of his childhood imagination and take a few deep breaths of cool air. There were many things which frightened Bobby in the darkness. Sometimes it was the memory of films or television shows he had seen which came back as distorted demons after the lights went out. Sometimes it was things he had heard on the news about murder or kidnapping, or the many ways in which man was capable of true evil. Sometimes it was simply the prospect of falling asleep, for it was then that he was at his most vulnerable. It was then that they came. There were always three of them. When they appeared in his dreams, they turned them quickly into nightmares. They stood together as if they were the same creature, but divided into three distinct parts. They were almost impossible to describe, and every time he tried to direct his mind in doing so, he found his focus blurring. It wasn't important, really. He knew that they were evil, and that was all that mattered. He could recall their build, tall and slender, and he knew that they were identical, except for their eyes. One had red eyes. He represented hate. He was the reason they were after him. He was the reason for their being. And in his eyes was such a hate that couldn't be reasoned with, no matter how much you begged or pleaded or tried to give them what they wanted. One of them had blue eyes, eyes that never got tired, eyes that could see for miles. Looking at them, you knew that they would never get tired of chasing you. The last one had eyes of pure light. These eyes could find you even in the dark. Seeing those eyes, you knew that there was nowhere left to hide. He also clearly remembered how they moved, slowly and deliberately, as if anything he did to escape them was utterly futile, and they knew it, so why hurry? As a group, they embodied the helpless terror of being relentlessly pursued by something malicious, tireless, and infinitely powerful. You could not reason, you could not stop them, you could not hide from them. All you could do was run. And as he ran, his legs felt like lead, his feet like they were dragging through treacle, and there was nothing he could do. Night after night it was the same, and it always ended in the same way. They would get within reach of him. They could feel him reaching forward to take him, and he could hear them release a hiss of victory. And then he would wake up. But just as he was doing so, his pursuers would raise their fingers to their mouths, as if gesturing that he was to keep silent about what had happened, as if it was a secret game that they only played with Bobby. Perhaps that was the most frightening thing about all of it. Bobby would lie awake and listen to his heart pounding, wondering if they would be waiting for him the next night, and when might his luck finally run out. Sometimes Bobby wondered what would happen if he betrayed this secret. What might creatures of such malevolence do if you disobeyed them? It is said that there is nothing more frightening than a fear you cannot name. So Bobby did so. He only ever had a glimmer of a memory about them, so he called them the Glimmer Men. He never told anyone about them, but occasionally he wrote what he could remember about his nightmares in an old exercise book. It was some small defiance against these monsters, which seemed to want their presence in his life kept a secret. It was in this disobedience that Bobby found some peace. Of course, as childhood ends, so too do the terrors which often accompany it. Bobby's fear of going to bed ended when his parents purchased a bedside light for him. Very soon, instead of lying petrified in darkness after his parents had said goodnight, he was able to read books or comics until he fell asleep. The dreams about the Glimmer Men ended more or less at the same time, and after a while the book he recorded his nightmares in was forgotten and tidied away, and the Glimmer Men became the barest glimmer of a memory. Childhood turned to adolescence, and Bobby no longer feared bedtime. Quite the reverse, it gave him time to read his books. In fact, by the time he was 16, he had developed into a creative and intelligent young man. He read voraciously and wrote stories of his own, the first of which was published just before he completed his exams. By the time he left university, Bobby's list of published material had grown to an impressive writer's curriculum vitae. It was this CV which quickly enabled him to earn a living as a freelance writer of magazine articles while he worked on fictional pieces for various publishers and even the occasional television show. This was how he met Craig. Craig was a full-time television writer who was trying to find the time to complete a novel. They met at a television writers' room meeting where storylines for a particularly long-running soap series were being discussed and planned. Craig was good company with a sharp wit and always seemed to have a story to tell. As it happened, he also had a room he was looking to rent in town, just as Bobby was growing tired of his hour-long commute. Bobby moved in as soon as possible, and the two quickly became firm friends. As a writer on a full-time contract, Craig was significantly better paid than Bobby, but this seemed to come with significantly greater pressure regarding delivery deadlines. Often at night, Bobby would go to bed noticing the light under Craig's door was still on, and hearing the clicking of Craig's laptop keys, Bobby knew that he would be working through the night. As the weeks turned to months, it was more and more the case that Craig would work astonishingly long hours as he struggled to create some workable plot or dialogue which would be needed on set, sometimes in a matter of hours. The pressure started to show in the lines on his face, and his personality seemed to become far dourer. Although he tried not to show it, Craig was exhausted and depressed. For Bobby, life couldn't have been any different. His general working pace was more relaxed, and while money was never plentiful, it was sufficient for his needs. The progress on his own book, a science fiction anthology he was looking to sell to an American publisher, was also going well. He had also met Jane, a beautiful, dark-eyed publisher's associate with whom he was beginning to spend more and more time. Professionally and personally, Bobby had never been happier, but he was worried about his friend, and this worry increased as he realized that he would soon be likely to be moving in with Jane, and he would see even less of Craig. It was on a rare night, when they were both at the flat and neither was working, that Bobby and Craig really discussed their futures. Bobby didn't want to leave Craig working at the obviously damaging levels that he was without saying something. It was then that a sparkle finally seemed to reappear in Craig's eyes.
I've been working on an idea for a series.
He almost panted the words, such was his obvious enthusiasm.
It's about this magician who uses a magic cabinet to travel to strange and dangerous worlds. I'm calling it The Cabinet of Astrolabius. I've already got one of them independent production companies interested, and I've also got a meeting with the Americans next month. Could be my ticket out of driving myself into the bloody ground writing love triangles for soaps.
Bobby was delighted. As a writer himself, he could see the passion in his friend's face. It was a passion he had frequently seen on his own. He passed Craig another can of lager as he continued explaining about how the structure of the stories would work and the characters would develop. For the next half hour, Craig barely paused as he pulled out notes and scenes. It seemed that he had already written the introductory episode and two others. He also had story breakdowns for the rest of what would be a 6-episode series. There was only one thing which seemed to be causing him some consternation.
What I need is a bad guy.
He frowned as he looked at his notes.
I need a proper enemy, like Darth Vader or the Daleks. I need someone that grabs the audience, someone I can bring back again and again without it getting boring.
They spent the rest of the evening puzzling the problem as they drank more and more. The evening ended with them both passing out with a list of ever more ridiculous or impractical ideas littering the floor around them. Bobby was glad that Craig had a project which might bring him some success, and he felt significantly relieved that when he moved out, he wouldn't be leaving his friend to wallow in work-related stress and depression. A few weeks later, Bobby did indeed move out, leaving Craig to continue to work on drafting and redrafting the scripted space series, an advance from an American television company picking up the financial slack of losing Bobby's rent. Strangely, the two friends spoke more frequently once Bobby had moved out than they had done in the last few months of living together. It seemed to Jane like every other night they would talk on the telephone, and Craig would ask Bobby's opinion on a plot device or character, and they would run lines from the script to see if they made sense when heard aloud. Eventually, Jane was forced to impose a ration on the amount of time Bobby was allowed to spend on the phone talking about what she called that bloody box man. In fact, she liked how the friends talked enthusiastically about their work. It was one of the things she found most attractive about Bobby in the first place. Everything changed a few days later when Bobby picked up the phone to a desperately excited Craig.
"You've got me, villain!"
he panted, barely able to contain himself. Bobby was intrigued. This had been a problem from the very beginning that neither had been able to find a solution to during their telephone discussions.
"You remember when you moved out, you left a box of old bits and pieces to get chucked out. Well, I was going through it last night, just to make sure you hadn't left anything you might want to keep, like, and I found your notebook."
Bobby could remember the box and the fact that there was little, if anything, of interest within. He had left all sorts of papers and books behind. As a writer, these things tend to proliferate if you let them. He couldn't for the life of him imagine what had been in any of them which had so inspired Craig.
"The Glimmer Men!"
Craig almost shrieked.
"I found them in some old notebook of your scribblings from your childhood, and they're perfect. evil incarnate, but with enough variety to make them interesting on the screen. They're the perfect bad guys, relentless, merciless, the stuff of a thousand childhood nightmares.
Bobby only became aware that he had stopped breathing when he tried to speak, and he had not air in his lungs to force the words out. Instead, he simply stood frozen to the spot as Craig began to talk through how these antagonists would be worked into the series.
Obviously, you'll get a credit. I mean, it's basically one of your childhood doodles which you're making come to life. I wouldn't want you not getting credit like that bloke who came up with the Klingons or whatever.
By now, Craig's words were just a background accompaniment to the sound of his heart pounding in his chest. Bobby tried to make sense of the sudden and astonishing physical reaction he was experiencing. He finally took a breath and realized that he would need to concentrate on not whimpering as he exhaled. He was sweating, and he could feel the clamminess of his hands against the smooth plastic of the phone. It was a few moments before he could say anything at all. When he did so, it was as a hoarse whisper.
The Klingon?
He croaked.
That's right. I was thinking of having them on screen as a female and two males, just to give it a bit of variety. Maybe even a mother, a father, and a child. Hey, that could work.
Bobby again stood in silence as Craig continued to give voice to the multitude of ideas which were now exploding in his mind after so many weeks and months of mulling over the problem. It was clear they were everything he'd been looking for. He barely heard Bobby as he finally managed a coherent reply.
But they're a secret,
Bobby said, finally finding his voice amongst the deep breaths and stifled whimpers. At first, it was as if Craig either didn't hear or didn't understand what Bobby was saying, and he continued, musing over costume and makeup design. When Bobby spoke again, it was louder, and Craig had no choice but to hear his words.
You can't tell people about them. They're a secret.
Craig was genuinely taken aback. Had he not explained that these silly ramblings of a child were the answer to the creative problem which had stumped them both? Furthermore, it potentially stood to make them both a tiny sum of money. He tried again to generate the appropriate level of enthusiasm in his friend.
So, the way I see them, they arrive in episode 3, just like we talked about. There's no point in wasting them in the first story, because we need that to set the scene. Episode 2 will be more of the same, with higher stakes, a chance for special effects people to have some fun. So by the time the big baddies show up, the viewers already know who the goodies are and what they're all about. Anyway, the way I see it...
Listen to me.
Bobby surprised even himself with the sharpness of the outburst and had to bite back the volume in his voice.
The Glimmermen are a secret. They're not for anybody else to know about. Not you, not the public. Not anyone. Do you understand?
Listen.
Do you understand?
Craig was astonished at this reaction and found himself quickly mumbling some excuse to end the call. When the line went dead, Bobby found himself standing with a phone in his hand, his hair and shirt matted with sweat and panting as if he had just woken from a terrible nightmare. In the days that followed, Bobby tried to call Craig, partly to apologize and partly to obtain reassurance that the Glimmermen as a creative concept would never leave the confines of Bobby's notebook. In spite of these efforts, it was 3 weeks before the two actually spoke again. Craig called Bobby one morning, and as he did so, he was businesslike, almost aloof.
Just wanted to let you know episode 3 is going ahead, just like we discussed. I've spoken to the producers. They're happy to offer you a credit, but...
Bobby listened to the words, his eyes wide with horror. In spite of their last conversation, he never once expected Craig to actually disregard his instructions and to use the Glimmermen in his script. Bobby found himself trying to reason with him, even begging him not to do as he was planning.
Please, you've got to listen to me. I don't know what those things are or where they came from, but I do know that they have to be kept secret. This whole thing is dangerous.
Really? What'll they do?
Craig's tone was just the humorous side of mocking.
If they couldn't get you with a childhood nightmare, I doubt they'll be jumping out of a doodling book from the 1980s and going for me throat now, will they?
You don't
get it.
Bobby's desperation was robbing him of the ability to make a reasoned argument. He was aware of how mad it all sounded, but he also knew deep down that nothing was more important than making Craig understand. But the words just wouldn't come. He blurted out some suggestion that they met, but Craig's voice once again lost all its warmth.
Look, I'd really like you with me on this, but I'm sorry the scripts are written. Filming starts in a couple of weeks. While I don't want to fall out with you about this, I'm going to use the Glimmer Men in the show, and I'm sorry if you can't bring yourself to support me.
The Glimmer Men. But they're a secret.
You can't tell people about them. They're a secret.
Not for much longer.
Craig replied and hung up. As Bobby walked slowly into the living room, Jane immediately noticed his pale, exhausted expression. And when she asked what was wrong, Bobby told her about Craig's intention to turn one of his creations into villains for his new television series. He held back that they were the product of his childhood nightmares, and he took care to never mention them by name. He didn't need to give too much detail. The rough outline of the situation was enough for Jane to suggest calling one of her friends, who happened to be a solicitor who specialized in intellectual property. Bobby agreed. The legal route seemed the last chance to stop Craig. Unfortunately, Jane's solicitor's friend, Hazel, was skeptical about their likelihood of success. By his own admission, Bobby had kept no paper trail, there had been no recorded meetings, and no real witnesses to any of the discussions between himself and Craig. In fact, Bobby didn't even have the notebook Craig had found the idea in. That notwithstanding, Hazel thought that an official-looking letter sent to the producer might be sufficient to bluff to frighten an organization keen to avoid scandal into telling Craig to use a different villain. As Bobby wasn't seeking money or recognition, there was a chance it might just work. Nathan, the producer of The Cabinet of Astrolabius, called their bluff. Nathan was a clever producer who realized that a minor scandal might give the show some useful free publicity in the press. He quickly sent an email replying to the cease and desist request, which practically dared further action. Hazel suggested a meeting. Nathan agreed, more to see how far the whole issue could be pushed than with any expectation of resolving it. When the two met, it was clear that this was what Nathan was looking to do. Aside from his assistant, there were no other television staff in the room, no legal advisors or even departmental heads, just Nathan, wearing a slightly irritating smirk on his face. Hazel opened her files and clarified her position. The case she set out was simple, that Craig had stolen the idea of the Glimmer Men from Bobby's personal notes. He had invaded his privacy and, without his permission, used material Bobby had written. Bobby was not seeking payment or acknowledgement of creators' rights. He simply wanted the story to feature a different villain. Surely that was reasonable. It may well have been had the process of production not already begun. Money had already been spent. Actors cast, costumes sewn, and sets built. To cancel now would cost money. And besides, it was undeniable that Bobby and Craig had discussed many times the subject of monsters for the show. Could it ever be proved that Craig had not developed the idea from one of these conversations, possibly even one about childhood nightmares? Did he really need to steal a child's imaginings from a notebook? And even if he did, who really owns the intellectual rights to a nightmare? The meeting with Nathan ended with a final offer of a co-creator credit. Hazel returned to Bobby, having legitimately done her best, but with precisely the result she expected. The following day, Bobby rose from a restless night to receive a call from a tabloid newspaper. They were asking for comment on the fact that he was suing a television company, claiming that he'd created a monster for their new show. The journalist even called them by their name, the Glimmer Men. Bobby tried to mumble a denial, but he could barely speak. No matter what he said, the story would run, and the secret would be out. Bobby hung up the phone and slid down the wall of his hallway, folding himself into a comforting ball on the floor. At the time, he had no idea that that particular news story would never be run. The reason for this was that a day later, the body of Craig was found at his home. A forensic pathologist noted that he had suffered horrific mutilations both before and after his death, in an ordeal which must have taken some hours with a number of people present. It was not long before the police came to Bobby's door, and in due course began to take a very considerable interest in his and Craig's argument. Bobby had an obvious motive, which Nathan, the series producer, was only too keen to divulge to the investigating officers and the tabloid press. There were also a number of emails and voice messages sent by Bobby, virtually begging Craig not to continue with his Cleaner Men project. Still being in possession of the keys to Craig's flat, Bobby also had opportunity. Finally, there was always the question in a jury's mind in cases such as these. If not the defendant, then who? There were no other even remotely reasonable suspects. In deciding whether to charge Bobby, the police ultimately had to weigh these circumstantial elements against a lack of significant physical evidence and the alibi his girlfriend Jane provided for him. At the time of the murder, they were in bed, asleep. It wasn't enough. Although questioned for some hours, the police were never able to make a sufficient case against Bobby to charge him. The murder of Craig Garrett may well have gone unsolved, but for one final twist. Asked later, Jane recalled that some days later, in the middle of the night, Bobby had awoken from a nightmare. He had suffered from them a lot recently. That night she had barely stirred as he got up from their bed, walked into their living room, turned on his laptop, and began to type. He was typing a confession to the murder of Craig, which he then sent to both the case investigating officer and a number of newspapers. A few moments after he had done so, he walked into the kitchen, took a knife from the drawer, and cut his own throat. Jane found him the following morning. Many speculated that Bobby's confession and suicide was because of guilt, but Jane was convinced otherwise. Firstly, she knew that he had not committed the murder. Her alibi was honest and truthful. So why had he confessed to it? Perhaps the nightmares of his childhood had finally caught him. Perhaps the Glimmer Men needed a scapegoat in order to remain a secret. Or perhaps Bobby was simply a far more damaged person than anyone ever imagined. We will probably never know. The Cabinet of Astrolabius went into production a month later, but from the start it was beset with problems. Two electricians were injured by a short circuit, and a stuntman was seriously hurt in an accident with a blank firing pistol. The Episode 1 production budget spiraled, and eventually it was decided that enough was enough. On the day television executives decided to shelve the series, there was a fire at the wardrobe department, which destroyed most of the costumes. Nathan, the producer, heard about this on his way home from the meeting, but he never reached his destination as his car skidded on a sharp bend and span into a ditch. He died instantly. The Cabinet of Astrolabius and its unknown villains, the Glimmer Men, are now in what people in television call development hell. And perhaps this is precisely where they should remain. After all, development hell certainly has an appropriate ring to it.